Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want positivity, hope, and examples of improving the overall health of humanity.
I'm Eric, and with my co-host Habanero. Charles Kep has carved out some time for us today. He's an eviction defense attorney in New York City, which is pretty cool. And he's going to tell us what life is like in that line of work. And Charles, why don't you tell us a little bit more about what you've got going so I give a more fair representation of what you're all about.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that was pretty much on the money right there. Yeah, I'm a young attorney in New York. I went to law school here in New York, graduated in 2022, and immediately after that, or close to immediately after that, began work with Brooklyn Legal Services. It's a nonprofit civil legal services provider that covers all five boroughs. Well, Brooklyn covers just Brooklyn, but you know, there's a broader office that covers all five boroughs, and have been doing, really primarily eviction defense. So we'll talk about it, I think, in a second, but there's some pretty new legislation in New York that gives every tenant, or essentially every tenant, the right to counsel in an eviction proceeding. And so that means there's a lot more lawyers that are needed and a lot of young folks stepping up. So I've been there for about a year.
It sounds like a pretty cool piece of legislation that's come across for folks. How do they get in that situation to begin with? So, you know, from your experience, talk a little bit about who winds up in this situation, what the circumstances are that finds them there, whether it's easy or hard to get an attorney. There's just a bunch of things going on, it would seem, that may not come to people's mind when they're in the middle of this kind of thing.
Yeah, sort of the way I kind of have come at it is, you know, when I started the job, my impression was that, you know, a lot of the cases that were being brought were legally bogus in some way. So there was some kind of procedural or substantive defense on legal grounds we could make in, you know, like an answer or a motion to dismiss the case or something like that. You know, as I've learned, or, you know, begun to learn after a year, really, I mean, the honest truth, the God's honest truth is that most evictions stem from poverty, right? So it's not a matter of some kind of technical legal claim that's being made that you have a chance to refute as a tenant. It comes down to cycles of poverty, and folks have lots of expenses besides rent. And if your income isn't high enough, you have to make choices about what you're going to pay for, you know, whether that's food, whether that's shelter, or whatever it is. And sometimes people fall behind on rent because of that. And so that's really what it is. Yeah, there's sort of two camps of eviction proceeding. One of those camps is called non-payment, and that's where the tenant doesn't pay their rent. The other is called holdover, which is basically any other reason you can evict someone. So things like nuisance, things like a violation of the lease that's not related to rent. The vast, vast majority of cases are non-payment cases. There's rarely disputes, serious disputes as to what's owed. I mean, oftentimes that's one of the first things you ask the tenant and or the client. Pretty much always they agree with what's owed, but they fell behind because, you know, rent's really high in the city. And again, there's other expenses that people have to take care of.
What percentage of the cases, you said the majority, what percentage of the cases that you handle are due to non-payment of rent?
I would say 70 to 80% of these are non-payment. And then 20 to 30 would be that other category I was talking about. It really does come down to non-payment of rent in most cases.
I think there is this tendency to think, oh, the evil landlord, or is it just this, you look, they can't pay anymore, that's the lease, and folks have got to move on.
Yeah, I mean, it varies. You know, it's rarely, I would say, that the evil landlord, but it's also, you know, it's people that have a bottom line, and that bottom line is getting the rent that they, you know, feel is due. So, you know, sometimes in the simplest of cases, it's a landlord that they don't have any interest in litigating every single issue with a tenancy. They just want to get paid, and they'll be more cooperative with you than other landlords in, let's say, if you want to apply for a subsidy for that tenant that will give them the rent, the money to pay their rent, they'll be more likely to cooperate. Sometimes I would say the worst case scenarios, the bad kind of landlord, is the landlord that's coming up with basically pretexts to evict people that are based on kind of bogus legal arguments, because we have a lot of rent stabilized apartments in New York City. And rent stabilized apartments, if folks don't know, is basically just an apartment that at the end of your lease, you're automatically guaranteed the right to a renewal. So when your lease ends, your landlord can't just say, you know, no thanks, we're done. And then also rent stabilized housing has built in percentages that the rent can increase each year or each lease term. So it's not market based, it's just based on what the rules are about the percentage increase. Right. So you'll have a lot of landlords that try and come up with reasons to get tenants out of their units, because if you have a rent stabilized tenant and you get them out of that unit, you can come up with ways to deregulate that unit. So maybe there's like one of the ways that can happen is if you do something called an individual apartment improvement. And what that is basically you can raise the rent in a rent stabilized apartment if you do some kind of material improvement to that apartment, some kind of repairs or expanding it or whatever it is. So oftentimes that can only happen if there's not a tenant in it. So you'll have cases like that where you try and get a tenant, you know, you being the landlord tries to get the tenant out of the apartment so that they can do that. So that's, I would say that's sort of what the evil landlord looks right. like in these situations.
But it's not typically the norm. Talk a little bit about why there's a need for legal representation. Enough need that there's, you know, legislation that gives people this right. That leads me to believe that it's a significant problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of like there's kind of like the philosophical case to be made, I guess, and there's sort of more down to earth, on the ground explanation, I would say. And philosophically, I think what it is I think a lot of folks are, and a lot of municipal governments are, and state governments even, are more seriously embracing the idea of housing as a human right. You know, that's something, you know, that's kind of trendy to throw around and say, but doesn't necessarily get, you know, internalized or realized as policy. And I think that's what right to counsel does. It's saying that, you know, getting evicted from your home is as serious a thing as, you know, getting put behind bars for a number of years, right? Because that's the only other situation in, you know, in law where you have an automatic right to an attorney. So, I mean, I think that that's sort of the philosophical crux is that, you know, if we say that housing is a human right, how do we put our money where our mouth is when we say that? And then, you know, there's sort of, like I was saying, there's just sort of the more kind of statistical argument, which is that as a matter of fact, when you do have representation or when a state or city, you know, government allows for automatic representation, you see that eviction numbers do drop pretty precipitously. So right to counsel came to New York in 2017. Prior to that time, I believe that it was something like 30 to 40% of eviction cases were resolved without eviction. And now it's okay. More like 80% that are
resolved. Oh, wow.
Do you think that you said it decreases when people have counsel. Do you think that's because the bad landlords are deterred from getting into those challenges? Or is there an expense for the other, maybe what we might call the regular landlords, you know, somebody who just has an extra place that they're renting out, or it's a family home that isn't being used right now and they don't want to get rid of it, but they want to rent it out, that they might have to put legal costs that maybe they don't want to get involved in?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that you have, I mean, one thing that you certainly have is not even so much bad landlords as the landlord attorneys, that if a tenant attorney comes in and you know, they're filing all these motions to dismiss the case on this ground and that ground, a lot of landlord attorneys have huge caseloads. So for them to dig into the legal specifics of any one case is actually kind of difficult for them or time consuming. And so because of that, because of these huge caseloads, and also because, right, it costs their clients money to defend against a motion to dismiss or to bring cases in the first place, you know, I think you do see that that is a deterrent. I think another big piece of it, though, is that if you have an attorney, you understand what kinds of agreements you're getting into, because most of these cases, what happens, I mean, there's very few eviction cases that go to trial, right? Pretty much all of them get settled. You got to be careful about using that word because that implies everyone goes home happy. Or what happened more often is you would have tenants get into settlement agreements with landlord attorneys. By the way, landlords are like 95% represented. So it used to be this crazy disparity of like less than 10% tenants represented and like 95% landlords. So you would have, you know, a tenant that was unrepresented enter into this agreement to repay whatever the landlord alleged was owed by a certain date. And they, you know, maybe don't understand how to get access to certain subsidies or just otherwise don't have the way to come up with that money. But if they don't, I mean, the settlement's kind of their only option. If you know, otherwise it's, they can, you can go to trial, but I mean, if you owe the money, you owe the money.
So what's the settlement typically? Is it just, you have to pay what's owed or how does that work?
Yeah, the settlement is typically you pay what's owed. What's owed a little lawyer can also help with, because a lot of the times, a lot of the charges that the landlord is trying to say are owed aren't really rent, so they don't qualify for housing court, or there might be a rent overcharge, meaning a tenant was charged more than the, you know, maximum legal rate that rent stabilization allows. And so you find out what that number is, what's owed. And then you typically agree to pay it back. And what you do is you set the payment date, typically like maybe a month, month and a half, or 2 months at most in the future. And then in the interim between that settlement date and the payment date, you can help guide your tenant or your client through the subsidy application process so that by the time that payment date rolls around, they can get approved for pretty comprehensive or, you know, pretty well-funded city and statewide subsidy program that essentially forgives rent up to $20,000.
Tell me a little bit about what the real challenge is here, though, because we started off with saying, look, you just can't afford to pay rent. And that seems kind of cut and dried. It seems like what a tenant needs is to understand options related to subsidies. And so I'm trying to figure out, is that what, you know, a lawyer can do? So for folks who are listening, they're thinking, you know, I may need legal services. And, you know, here in Asheville, we have an organization called Pisgah Legal Services, and they could call Pisgah Legal Services. But what could they expect to get? What problem could an attorney help them to solve?
Yeah, I mean, public benefits, navigating the public benefit system is a huge part of it. And that ties into, you know, a point I was making earlier that, you know, a lot of the work you're doing isn't really traditionally legal work in the sense you might think of it. So it's not so much concocting these amazing legal arguments that prove that there's actually no rent owed or, you know, the case is defective. It's helping clients navigate the very confusing, very, you know, bureaucratic and just inefficient public benefit system in the city. So, you know, we all get trained on how to, first of all, how everyone qualifies for different kinds of benefits so that you know, right, when you speak to a client, if they qualify for something that you can apply for. And also an insider baseball type thing here. For a lot of these sort of public benefits agencies, they're more receptive to an attorney reaching out on behalf of a tenant than they are to the tenant themselves, which, you know, is, there's a whole conversation about whether it should be that way, I think.
Right.
I'm going to argue that you probably know the right words to use, and you've been, as opposed to a tenant who's just flailing or crying or worried about all of the things that cause them to not be able to pay the rent in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Health problems, yeah. Family problems,
yeah.
That landlord's, I mean, not taking care of things and the tenant has to do it. So the tenant isn't necessarily going to be focused on using the right terminology to get the help they need.
That's definitely a huge part of it. Just, you know, obviously everyone going through this is going through a ton of trauma. And these centers that you go to apply for these benefits, you can do it online now, but it used to be you have to go to a center. And I mean, it's like the DMV on steroids. I mean, you can be there for 6 hours. You can be there your whole working day and folks have to work so they can pay the next month's rent. So it's, you know, it's difficult for folks to do that on their own.
You know, housing prices, rent, or just home prices are just going up. So this issue of not being able to pay your rent is probably just, it's going to be with us. What would you tell people that they don't know that they need to look out for when they may be faced with this? Most communities probably have a legal services organization they can turn to. Like I mentioned the one here in Asheville. Obviously, there's one in New York. What are the things they should be asking about in terms of representation and support from the kind of services that you offer?
One of the number one things we tell clients is before you even get to that point, keep receipts, right? I mean, document everything, because a lot of the times if you do have a genuine rent dispute, it's difficult if the client, if you don't know, if you can't prove that you paid a certain month, even if you know you paid it, that can be difficult. And sometimes that's an issue. So I think that's huge to know. The other thing I would just say is, and unfortunately it's kind of depends on where you live. New York is lucky enough to have these subsidy programs, but I mean, it's important to know about what options are there for you to get the assistance you need to pay rent. So I don't think a lot of people know necessarily that in New York, we have something called a one-shot deal, which is a one-time payment for arrears up to $20,000. And the way you qualify for it is you have to be working and make more in a month than your rent is in a month. And so for a lot of people that fell behind on rent because they make more than their rent, but not by a lot, and they have other expenses, that's an option. $20,000 is obviously, that's, you know, depending on what your rent is, I mean, that's a lot of months right there. Right. So I think just, you know, maybe there needs to be better sort of public education around what sorts of programs exist for needy folks in the city. You know, there's another program that can do the same thing for people, even if they're not working, but if they have a child under 18 in the household. I think that's the big thing that a lot of folks don't realize when they go to housing court is that, you know, there do exist programs that help people with this, because the city is coming to a realization that evictions they're not stomachable for a lot of people, certainly not for the tenant, but also I think for a, you know, a healthy, thriving city. So, you know, I think a good progressive policy is to have those subsidies in place.
People are looking for someone to hold responsible for this whole situation. And a lot of time, I mentioned this before, it could be landlords. From your experience, to what degree are landlords and even their attorneys responsible for creating homelessness? I know that's an extreme case, but through eviction, are they responsible for pushing up the rate of homelessness?
It's tough. That's a good question. I mean, I think that, look, you know, you have mom and pop landlords. I've certainly had cases against mom and pop style landlords that only own, you know, a property or two. And I've had I had a case recently where this was actually not a non-payment case. So the other kind of case where they wanted to evict because the tenant wasn't allowing the landlord into the premises, you know, ever. And he had requested that there be repairs done, and he still wasn't letting the landlord in to do the repairs. And so it was difficult because, I mean, it was difficult for a lot of reasons, but one of the things about it was the landlord was trying to repair the apartment. I mean, there were pretty significant conditions issues, and it was a good faith attempt to actually address those. And he didn't have the resources to relocate the family in this apartment while the repairs were being done, because it was, again, pretty significant. So that was a tough situation where it's like, you know, in a sense, we're adversarial, of course, because I'm trying to preserve this tenancy and you're trying to do the eviction. But on the other hand, you would have conversations with, you know, the landlord's attorney where he was like, look, you know, at the end of the day, he really doesn't want to evict this guy, this family. Actually, it was a huge family in this apartment. So, and the landlord got that was, you know, not the most savory thing to do, not the most savory thing to pursue. So you have cases like that where it's like, okay, you know, this landlord is a human being. In that case, it was literally a human being, which is not common in New York. And that's the other camp. And there I would say it's a bigger, you know, it's a bigger part of the problem, right? You have these landlords that aren't people, they're companies. And they own tons and tons of properties, and they're trying to deregulate as many of them as possible by coming up with phony reasons to evict tenants. You have retaliatory landlords. I haven't talked about that, where a tenant might make a complaint about conditions issues, which is also a huge problem in the city. And after they make that complaint, you know, the landlord retaliates by bringing an eviction proceeding, you know, again, premised on something phony, some kind of, you know, a nuisance claim where the nuisance is that the tenant has a five-year-old kid that, you know, runs across the floor sometimes, right? I think it just varies depending on the type of landlord. At the same time, I think it's important, anyone that's becoming a landlord, I think, or considering becoming a landlord has to realize that part of the game is if push comes to shove, are you willing to force someone to lose their home? Which I think is, that alone, I think, is questionable.
If you were to break it into camps, call it like the mom and pop or the family may own a few properties compared to more of an enterprise or a corporate or business type focus, do you find that one or the other is more likely to be less lenient with their tenants?
Yeah, I mean, it gets weird here too, because it's not, you have to remember, it's not just the landlords, it's the landlord attorneys. And right. Every, you know, there's repeat players in housing court, right? I mean, I know pretty much every landlord attorney face I see in court at this point. So every firm has a different style of litigating and different levels of reasonableness, where you might have, you know, I've had clients where you want to ask for a rent abatement, a reduction in the rent because of conditions issues, and you write it up in an agreement, the rent will be reduced by X amount, and they skim it for a second and go, yeah, sure. And they just, it's like they didn't even read it. They didn't realize they just committed their client to like a 50% reduction in rent. So you have situations like that, but then you have landlord attorneys that want to play hardball, fight you on everything. They won't even agree to adjourn the case if it's like the first appearance and you just want to adjourn to have more time to speak with your client because you just got the case. They'll give you a hard time about that. But I think what you find is that most of the big, more corporate landlords are the ones that have these more intense kind of eviction mills, they're sometimes called. These firms that, you know, their whole job is just taking, you know, hundreds of eviction cases and you know, trying to deliver for their clients on as many as they can.
It's interesting because you're talking a lot about how hard it is in New York. And I think that people who have been in that situation, I know I've been in rent stabilized apartments in New York, to come to Asheville, North Carolina, where there are really such incredibly limited tenant protections at all. It's just so different. So, you know, I know that some of the people who are listening to this are probably thinking, you know, oh my gosh, if I even had a half inch of rights that I could cling to, as opposed to, you know, my landlord decides they're selling the house and I get 30 days and that's it. My landlord decides that they want to turn it into an Airbnb, I just got to get out and there's no recourse. The whole housing tenants' rights rental situation is really, really challenging here. There are so many people who are totally being pushed out.
Right.
For a variety of reasons.
Right.
So,
yeah. I mean, I've had a similar thought. It's like, you know, if it's this hard in New York City, I mean, think about how difficult it is to defend against an eviction case in, you know, places that don't have, I mean, I think New York's one of like three places, I think, that has right to counsel, or maybe four, you know, San Francisco.
Forget about right to counsel, tenants' rights to even attempt to protect.
Right.
So,
yeah. Even rent stabilized or rent regulated. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No.
And that's kind of what I wanted to get into, ways of helping folks think through this, where there are no subsidies or there's no way to get, you know, some sort of protection from legislation, and kind of look at who they might be renting from. Would you suggest that people do that? Is think about who you're renting from, do a little research. Can you kind of sniff out who's going to be a good landlord and who's not?
I think it's tough, practically speaking, because, you know, a lot of folks don't have that sort of luxury of choice, or it's difficult to really know much about your landlord before you start renting from them. I think it's tough for a lot of people are just, you know, they're looking for that, whatever, they're looking for the dwindling supply of rent stabilized apartments. And then they see one and it's like, well, I mean, this is what I can afford. So I have to do this. I mean, I encourage, to the extent people can, I encourage them to look into it's a good you bring this up, because there's a, and this is another New York thing that it's like, this should probably be everywhere, right? And this isn't a law. It's a website someone created called Who Owns What? And you can type in any property address and it'll pull up the landlord. It'll show you all the outstanding conditions violations for that apartment. It'll show you any tax credits that apartment's getting, because if an apartment gets certain tax credits, that makes it rent stabilized. And you might not be aware of that if you just, you know, you probably wouldn't be aware of that if you just moved in. It'll tell you if they have the right certificate of occupancy on. You can get a decent sense of you know, what kind of landlord you're dealing with through that. So that's actually a great point. And something that, again, I don't really think that's super common, but, you know, an easy to use database that anyone that doesn't know anything about law can use to learn about landlords, I think, is huge.
New York is a little bit more progressive than a lot of other states. So I think people can understand what they should be demanding. I think in a lot of cases, people don't know what their options are and what's out there. They just accept. And I think what this has helped with is help people understand that they don't necessarily have to accept. What they need to do is ask, though, and demand things from their politicians. Habanero, do you have any more questions?
Actual FM has done some programming to understand a little bit more and report on what's happening locally. Hopefully, this will give people some idea of what kinds of things are possible if you've got laws. And really, that's really what it comes down to, the laws that can help support tenants or provide them with support.
Charlie, thank you so much for your time. It was very, very enlightening. And I would take away a few things. One is the fact that there needs to be lawyers on both sides, representing landlords and representing evicted tenants, tells me that this is a serious problem. And as we talked about, it's a simple matter of not being able to pay the rent. And you can't pay your rent because either the rent's too high or you don't make enough money, or it's both. So the solution then is we raise wages. We have a floor on the minimum wage so that it's a living wage and people can afford to pay their rent. Or we get into things like rent stabilization and forcing landlords to not be able to raise their rents past a certain point. That would cause a furor among landlords. So then we could say that, well, the government should provide more government housing. Well, that's going to increase taxes and all the things that come with it. You know, not in my neighborhood and all kinds of things like that. And my question is we're so far past a market-based solution to this. And that's clear because the market is forcing people out of their homes. And so it seems like it has to be a government policy, but ideally it would come from the landlords being willing, and maybe some are, willing to be more lenient and patient. And I'll tell you what, if they are, then it does come down to wages and the fact that people are not making enough money. And that goes back to people complaining about how corporations are basically doing as little as they can to support their own workers. And that's a completely different thing. And I know that's a lot to get from a conversation about eviction, but it's all tied together. And we really have to come together as a society and say, what does justice look like? And you heard Charlie talk about the fact that housing is a right. Well, if it's not a right, this is what you get. People can't even afford to hold up their end of the deal on rent. Again, Charlie, really appreciate you coming in today. Have a great day, everybody. If you like this show, tell your friends to go to ashevillefm.org. Click on shows and scroll down to Solutions for the Underaffiliated. There you can listen to the last 2 weeks of this program. Check all our podcasts of this show at underaffiliated.com and stream Asheville FM live from the site or the app.